Good morning. Would you pray with me? Dear Father, we thank you for this lovely day. We thank you that you are a God who invites us on this adventurous life with you. We thank you for this place, this moment, this time that you've given us, Father, to draw nearer to you. I pray for every one of us here today, Father, that you would incline our hearts towards what is right. I pray that you would teach us new ideas that we could live out day after day after day and help us grow into these men and women that you've called us to be. I pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen. When my husband and I were first married, I remember how fun it was to move into our new house and get stuff set up and make it feel like our home and our place together. And at our wedding, somebody gave us a really fun present. It was a basket filled with all kinds of good things to make, dinners and snacks and treats. So it had like different pastas and sauces and breads and crackers and different desserts and cake mixes you could make. And we'd just gotten settled into our house, and I was home on my day off, and I thought, I'm going to be such a good wife today, and I'm going to, like, cook dinner and make dessert, and I'm going to be so awesome. So I took some of the recipes, I made one of the cake mixes, and I mixed it all together, popped it in the oven while I was getting some other stuff done, and took it out, let it cool, put the icing on it, and, you know, patting myself on the back for being an amazing homemaker in this minute. And it wasn't anything fancy. It was just a sheet cake, you know, with like the sprinkles and stuff that you put on it. And of course, when you make cake, you have to eat it, right? You have to have a piece of the cake that you just made because you can't serve bad cake. And so I ate a nice piece of cake and moved on, but it was so good, I had to go back and get more. And so I went back and I got another piece and I was doing stuff. And eventually I stopped actually cutting pieces and I just like would go to the cake and like cut a little section off. Have you done that before? Like, I'm not fully admitting that I'm eating a piece of cake. I'm just taking little divots out of there so it doesn't actually count. I don't know. It's true. It's real. And it entered my mind somewhere throughout the day, like, I should probably stop. I've had more than enough cake, but it was good. And I just kept going back and taking little pieces and little pieces. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me. I looked at the cake and I'd eaten about 3/4 of it. Don't judge me. You've done this before. I see it in your eyes. I'm not kidding. It was a sheet cake and I'd eaten like 3/4. 75% of the cake was gone. And I was so like, first, I was sick to my stomach with embarrassment. Like, I can't blame it on anybody. Like, we didn't have a party. Like, there was nobody there. I could say, like, maybe they had a piece or two or three. Like, all by myself, I did it. And then, of course, the stomach ache set in, and I got horribly sick, and I couldn't even think about cake or eat cake for a really long time. But have you had this happen before? Like, this idea comes up, and these impulses, we're like, maybe I shouldn't, but it's so good, maybe I should, and we find ourselves not being able to stop doing something. Like, where did all the self-control go? Like, why can't I tell myself no and, like, stick to my no-ness, that why can't I just do better, right? Like, why did I let this happen? I know better. Why can't I just be a little bit stronger and not give in to this one thing? And what happens is we treat self-control as the last stop effort and we lose. Just like the cat who's staring at the chicken and can't make itself walk away from the chicken, we have these big overwhelming impulses and we say, okay, I'm going to depend on my self-control in this moment, but we don't have the willpower to say no and we end up giving in. And what happens is when we make self-control the last-ditch effort, we lose again and again and again. It looks something like this. Do you ever say, I'm not going to spend any money? Like, we say this all the time with my kids. We're on a spending freeze. We spent a lot of money on good stuff, and now we're going to save up for the next thing that we're going to do, and we're on a spending freeze. I'm not going to buy anything. I'm not giving in. And then you're at the store and you have no intention to buy stuff. You're just looking, right? Like, there's just stuff there. But then all of a sudden, that credit card is burning a hole in your wallet and you find these really good deals, right? And you start rationalizing in your head, like, this is such an amazing deal. I can't pass this up. Like, I would be a fool not to save on this discount. And so all of a sudden, we start talking ourselves out of a decision that we made and we're rationalizing why it's okay and it's such a good deal and I'll never get something again like this. I don't need to pay this one thing now. I can pay that later and we can do this instead. And suddenly you walk out buying all of this stuff that you said, I have no intention of buying. And then the new wears off, right? And all of a sudden you're like, what was I thinking? I knew better. I had a plan and I didn't want to do that. And it happens with food and with drinking and gambling and addictions and all these temptations that we have that we say, I'm not going to do that thing. I'm not going to let it happen. And then our self-control feels like we don't have the willpower to say no. We want to do one thing that we know that we shouldn't, or we know we should do something, but we just really don't want to, so we end up doing nothing at all. And this lack of self-control, it ends up compromising our judgments. It compromises our common sense and even our confidence, because you make the same mistake again and again and again, and it's hard not to feel like a failure. You do the thing that you say you don't want to do again and again and again, and it's hard not to call yourself a jerk, right? Like, it's hard not to beat yourself up inside your own head. But the truth is, self-control was never supposed to be this last-ditch effort that we tried to depend on in the moment. Instead, it's supposed to begin before we even find ourselves facing a problem. Look at what it says in Proverbs 25, verse 28. It says, a man without self-control is like a city broken into and left without walls. Solomon wrote this, and he's one of the smartest guys ever. And he says, a person who doesn't have self-control, let me just give you a visual image of what that might look like. It's like a city that gets broken into and doesn't have the right walls up for protection. What happens is, if you don't have the walls, you're defenseless, and you open yourself up to all kinds of harm. Now, cities were built with the idea of you get everything inside the city and then you build these walls around it. So if anybody's coming to attack you, they literally have to go through the walls first. The walls are the front line of defense for the city. So anybody coming to do harm has to get through those walls first. They've got to wage a real hard campaign to either knock those walls down or find a way through before they can get to you. But the walls also serve another purpose of you get to be in charge of who you let in the city and who you let out. You had one gate or one door or one drawbridge you'd have to lower, and that's where everybody could come in and out. So as the leaders of the city, you had guards in place to say, I get to choose and decide who gets in the city and who we let out. Is it safe? Do they have good intentions? Do they come bearing harm? And it gives you all kinds of defense for the city when this wall is up and protecting you. But what happens is, if the wall isn't there, your city's left defenseless. If there's a breach in your wall, if it's broken, if it's knocked down, anybody could come in, anybody could come out, and it's much harder to protect your city when the walls aren't there to keep you guys safe. This visual that Solomon gives us for this wall gives us an incredibly great image to think about how self-control works in our life, because self-control is to us what the wall is to a city. It's there for protection. It's there to keep our minds and our hearts and our souls and our characters protected from the things that would do harm. What happens is self-control allows us to decide what we let in and what we let out. Self-control becomes our first line of defense and helps us think about the actions that we make and the choices that we make, and it lets us decide how we protect ourselves. That's the image we have when we think about how self-control works. But here's it. You don't get to build the wall when the army is coming. Think about it. The city didn't see the army like charging like a mile off and be like, okay, really quick, get those stones up, let's build a wall, let's get protection in place. Instead, they build the wall when there's no enemy to attack, and so they're ready for when the enemy comes. They don't throw it up last minute because there's not enough time. It's not a good measure. It's not a good plan. It wouldn't keep you safe. It'd knock over easily, and anybody could get through. But the same thing is true with self-control. We don't try to throw up walls of self-control like in the minute of the hard impulse or when we're surrounded by overwhelming temptation or where we're in a defeatable moment. We say, okay, let's get up that wall really quick. Instead, self-control is a plan we make way ahead of time when we think through how to manage our lives, when we evaluate who we are and how we feel and the choices we've made and the kind of people that we want to be. Self-control isn't a last-ditch effort. We lose every time out that way. Instead, it's a plan we put in place ahead of time. It's proactive. It's something we think about before the problem happens instead of trying to react in the moment and do the best that we can. Self-control becomes this disciplined way of thinking that helps us work our way through problems and struggles before we find ourselves in them. And what happens is when we treat it this way, it starts building in us the strength to learn how to do the right thing. Because without self-control, our life gets left unprotected. Without self-control, we don't have the measures in place to help defend ourselves when we inevitably will face hard moments. And here's the truth. My hard moments might look different than your hard moments, and my impulses might look different than your impulses, but we all have them. The truth is we all kind of struggle in different ways, and it looks different, but we all have them. And we fool ourselves to say, well, I don't have this problem, so I'm okay. Like, I don't deal with that, so clearly I'm a good person, and I don't have to worry about it, right? Like, we might struggle in different ways, but all of us need self-control. All of us have areas in our life that we've let go unchecked, and it's been doing damage to us, it's been doing damage to relationships, and it's pulling us farther and farther away from the kind of person that we really want to be. If we really want self-control to work in our life, we have to come up with a plan ahead of time. I have to have a plan for when I've got no willpower left, because willpower is limited. It is a depleted source. And guess what? When you've been peck, 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 pecked at all day and you're done, you don't have a lot of willpower left, do you? Right? You got to have a plan in place before you snap and start yelling at the children. You've got to have a plan in place before you're in a meeting and you're so annoyed with everybody that you lose your patience on everybody that you work with. You have to have a plan in place before you face the overwhelming temptation that gives you options to fall back on and learn what to do differently. So, while it's a great visual, there's also a truth that says, I can't literally build a wall around myself, right? Like, I would love to, it would be easier sometimes, but I can't literally walk around encased in a stone wall. That would be silly and people would laugh at me and it wouldn't really work well. So how do we live in a kind of way that takes this metaphor and makes it become a reality that we can actually do something with? Because God didn't design us to live our lives unprotected. God didn't leave us without tools and measures that we can instill in our lives to start learning how to choose differently. God didn't leave us alone and without options on how to do life in a better kind of way. He did design us in the kind of way to learn how to protect ourselves. He did design us in the kind of way that says, yes, there are struggles. Yes, there are temptations. Yes, there are ugly impulses that bubble up with them, but we aren't a slave to them. We are not a slave to our emotions. We are not a slave to our anger. We are not a slave to our bad impulses. Instead, we, each one of us, can learn new tools and new skills that help us learn how to face these times differently. And God designed self-control as one of those options, one of those skills that we can learn that help us live better, that help us create the right kind of defenses in our lives. So instead of feeling like it's all out of our control, right? Well, I just don't have enough willpower. I can't really do it. Well, I just don't have, you know, a strong enough ability to say, no, it's outside of my control. No, we all get to say, I can be in control. I can change things. I might have sucked in the past, but that doesn't mean I have to right now. I can make different choices and learn how to grow in self-control. Instead of saying the only option I have is my depleted willpower, instead, I can start looking how to cultivate and learn the ability of self-control and improve. And the good news is this. Doesn't matter what level we're at today, everybody can improve. It doesn't matter how depleted this week has pushed my willpower and my sense of strength down. Every single one of us can learn to improve and grow in self-control. It is a learnable skill. It is something that you can practice and grow in, and every one of us have the ability to grow new habits and create new options that allow us to manage our life differently. With practice, we can all grow and develop this ability together. It's an awesome tool that God gave us. it is an awesome ability that God challenges us with. Look, you can grow and you can change. And when you decide that you want to be a different person, let's start talking about some of the practices that we can start using today to grow into these men and women that he's called us to be. So how do we do that? Over the next couple of weeks, we're going to dive into a lot of different aspects of self-control, how to develop it, how to grow it, the purpose of it, how to create this healthy defense in our life. But I want our starting point today to just be how we think about it, how we think about self-control in our life, and this awareness that we have of our own selves helps us take that first step forward on the path. Usually, we have this wrong thinking. And it goes something like this. If I just could be strong enough, if I could just have enough willpower, if I could just make myself not do it next time, it wouldn't be a problem. And then what happens? Next time rolls around and we do it. And we think, well, I'll try again. I'll try harder next time. The problem is we lose this way. Because if willpower were enough, we could will ourselves into all of the things we say, right? Like I could will myself into losing weight. I wouldn't have to change anything. I would just will it hard enough and I'd have a six-pack abs and everything would be great, right? Like if I could just will it into, I could control my anger. I could control my grouchiness. If I could just will myself into not giving in next time, that unhealthy impulse rises up, everything would be fine. But willpower alone isn't enough. Because we don't have enough of it, and it gets depleted throughout the day. If it were, everybody would keep New Year's resolutions. You'd only have to make it one time, and you'd keep it. You wouldn't have to the next year round be like, well, I didn't do it last year, but I'm going to do it this year, right? If willpower were enough, that would happen. But time and time again, we find we can't depend on our willpower in the moments because we don't have enough of it. Instead, self-control gets to be the thing we use to master ourselves. It gets to be the strength that we use to work through our thoughts, our behaviors, our actions, and the things that we do. Self-control becomes this fascinating idea of self-management. There's been a ton of study over the last two decades about this idea, and here's what they're finding. IQ, if you've ever taken an IQ test, like how smart you are, the ability that you have to learn, what they're finding is it's not an accurate measure of success. And you've seen this. People who are so smart and have all the talent in the world and don't do anything with themselves, who aren't living successful lives because just sheer intelligence, IQ, isn't enough. So they went back to the drawing board and they started testing and figuring out there's another important layer and they call it EQ, our emotional intelligence. And what emotional intelligence is it's this ability to manage ourselves and our relationships, our social ability effectively. And so self-control is a huge deal in the emotional intelligence world that's called self-management. And this is the ability to manage myself. It's my job to take care of myself, right? Like it's not somebody else's job. It's not somebody else's fault. We talked about blame, remember? It's so easy to say, well, they made me angry. It's their fault I lost my temper. No. Like they can make you angry, but you're the one who's in control of your temper. It's nobody's fault when we lose it except our own. They can stir it up in us, but we all get the option to say, I might be angry. I might be so spitting mad I want to say ugly things, but I don't have to. And what emotional intelligence says is when we learn how to self-manage, we start becoming aware of who we are, what our triggers are, what our shortcomings are, and what our strengths are, and we start learning how to manage ourselves in the kind of way that takes ownership of who we are, of the life that we live, the emotions that we feel, and the things that we want to do with our life. It's this incredible ability to keep disruptive emotions and impulses under control. And so it turns the question not from, could I just get more willpower, right? Like, could I just get strong enough to do better? Instead to, how do I manage my emotions? How do I better manage my behaviors? So instead of being the jerk all of the time, I have more positive outcomes with these choices that I'm making. And it helps us start thinking about who we are and what we do before we just start acting on how we feel. So we start thinking about these skills that we need. How do I manage myself? How do I get better in control of who I am and who I want to be? So Travis Bradbury wrote a book called Emotional Intelligence 2.0. It's a very, very interesting book. It's a pretty quick, easy read. If you like reading, it's a good one to write down and you can kind of dive in a little bit deeper. But he says we got to start with recognizing how our emotions work. Listen how fascinating this is. It says everything that we see, smell, hear, taste, touch, all of it travels through our body in these electrical signals. And what happens is they pass from our cells until they reach our brain, and they got to get to our frontal lobe before reaching the place where all of our rational thinking takes place. But what happens is, before we get to our rational thinking place of our brain, it has to go through our limbic system, which is the place where all of our emotions are produced. So everything that you experience has to pass through the emotional part of your brain before it gets to the rational, which means our brains are hardwired to feel emotion first and rationality second. I know, it's shocking, right? And also it feels a little bit like it, I get it, this is why I'm emotional. What happens is, our first reaction to events are emotional. And whether we acknowledge it or not, or whether we give it any credit or realize it or not, it goes through our emotional side first before any type of logic starts taking place. Now, emotions are good and logic are good. We need both of these to be human, right? We need both of these to function and make good choices. But emotions can help you or they can hurt you. Depending on the awareness of our emotions, they can either help us be aware and cognizant and think about how things feel to us and empathize with others, but they also can be incredibly damaging when we let our emotions run wild and become slaves to whatever we feel in the moment, how we feel. He says, when you understand your own emotions, you can respond the way you choose to them. You have the power to take control of difficult situations, react nimbly to change, and take the initiative needed to achieve your goals. You have no say in the matter until you understand them. Until we understand the emotions we feel, we don't get to pick whether they hurt us or help us. They just are. And what we know is true. Look, emotions are real. We feel them. They're part of how our body functions in our system, but they don't always tell us the truth. There's a ton of fascinating research into this idea of while all of these ideas and thoughts and things that we see and the things we're trying to process go through, what happens is between the emotion and the logic side, we tell ourselves a story. And in this thing, this is where we get to challenge the truth. Is the story I'm telling myself true? Somebody does something that makes you grouchy, and you instantly, whether you're aware of it or not, tell yourself a story that helps you process how you feel about what they just did. And the story could go, well, they're a jerk, and they don't really appreciate me, so I'm going to respond this way. And sometimes that happens so quickly, we don't even feel ourselves doing it. Or we've experienced something in our past, and we lean right back on that story. Well, everybody's done this before, so this is going to end the same way, too. And what happens is emotions tie into our self-control. How we feel about things, how we process who we are and what we're thinking affect our self-control. Guess what? We don't make great decisions when we feel like crap, right? We just don't. We're looking for things that help us feel better. And in the moment, the tension of feeling bad is larger than everything else. And so what we're looking for is things to get the feeling bad down, and the decisions we make are based on that. And we don't make our best healthy choices when we feel terrible, right? Or the other thing that happens is our emotions like to like pick at us a little bit. Like you ever say like, okay, I'm going to eat healthy, I'm going to get rid of all of the junk, and you're working really good, but then you see somebody else eating something that you want to eat that you told yourself you can't eat, and you're like, well, how come they get to eat it? Like, why do they get to eat it and I can't eat it? That's not fair. And our emotions start running haywire. Or why do they get to drink? Or why do they get to smoke? Or why do they get to do that and I don't get to do that? And then all of a sudden we find ourselves emotionally talking ourselves out of these choices that we've made. So instead, what happens is we need to teach our brain new habits. We need to help our brain understand that, yes, while I feel certain ways, my emotions are not the only factor to consider. And he talks about this idea of plasticity, and basically what it means is your brain's ability to change. what happens is your brain can grow new connections just like your biceps can grow. If you're trying to get stronger and lift weights, you can actually lift weights, follow a plan, and your muscles and your biceps, they get bigger by flexing them and growing them. Well, the same thing happens in our brain. When we try new things, we start running all of these new pathways in our brain, all of these new connections, and one single cell, they said, can grow 15,000 connections in your brain with its neighbor. And this chain reaction of growth, it helps it make it possible for us to change behaviors, to go stronger in our mental thinking ability, and to kick in these new resources that we want to do. But it requires practice. I don't change if I don't ever try out the new things that I want to do. Just like my muscles will never change, I can't will them into getting big, but I can do certain exercises that will help me grow them. In the same way, my mind, my brain has the ability to change and grow when I practice and challenge it with new ideas. So what happens is it takes effort, a ton of effort up front to try a new thing, to get a new behavior going, to pick up a new habit. But once you train your brain to start doing something, those connections it creates start working and channeling different processes. Okay. This whole thing starts with awareness, because before I can change something, I gotta be aware of it first. And self-awareness isn't always fun. It's a little bit uncomfortable, but it's 100% necessary. And it starts with us asking this question: how aware am I, how aware are we of the areas in my life that I need self-control? Like, have you ever just, it's not a comfortable question to ask, because we like to think best of ourselves. And like, some things are like blaringly obvious, right? Like if I'm Arnold Schwarzenegger yelling "shut up" really loudly at a bunch of children, that's an area I could grow in self-control, right? If I'm cramming a lot of food into my face and making myself sick, that's an easy place to identify, right? When we fall off the bandwagon, or when we give in to temptation or have these lapses in judgment, some of these bigger things are easier to capture. But other areas are a little bit harder to identify. Like, how aware am I of the emotional triggers in my life? There are people who trigger certain emotions in us, and those emotions run rampant. We spend 15 minutes in their presence, and it's like we lost a year off our life. Have you been there? Have you been like, you're so frustrated with something, and you think you've worked through the frustration, and then you go home, and for like a week, you're still having the conversation in your head. Like, you're still running the cycle of the conversation. You're like, well, you know what? I'm right. They're wrong. This happened. This didn't. If they would just dot, dot, dot. And we have all of these frustrations that we've let take up all of this space in our mind, and we stew on it again and again and again. How aware am I of the self-control I need in my thoughts? We win or lose the battle in our head first. How aware am I of the fight that I'm fighting, if I'm winning or I'm losing, in the way that I'm thinking through the negative thoughts that go through my head? How about honesty? When's the last time I did a self-check on my self-control with honesty? Not because I'm lying in the kind of way that people are like, well, it's obvious, but those little things, those little corners that we shave off, those little places that we just don't tell the 100% truth, that build up and build up and build up over time. Or following through. How aware am I in the way that I need self-control to just do the things that I said I was going to do, that people can count on me to get them done? Fear. How aware am I of the self-control I need to get fear to stop leading my life decisions? Fear is a jerk, and it lies, and it takes hold of our emotions, and man, it shuts us down real quick. But when's the last time I ever pushed back and said, I can manage that differently? I feel it. I feel it. It's there. But because I feel it doesn't mean I have to respond the same way I've always responded before. So Travis Bradbury, he gives a lot of strategies. I'm going to condense them to a few for you. And it starts with, what are some strategies to start working in our life for self-awareness? So I'm going to give you, I think there's six of them today. I lost track of my numbers. Yeah, six. So if you want to write these down, this is a good thing to keep a list of. And you can pick one. Pick two. I mean, go crazy and pick three. Don't feel like you have to conquer all six this week, but what if you just tried one of these strategies and spent a little bit of time thinking through who you are and how aware of self you are? So here's the number one place he starts. He says, number one, quit treating your feelings as good or bad. said what happens is, in our nature, we really want to condense and create these two simple piles of emotions. Bad emotions, good emotions, right? The bad emotions are, they make us feel bad, and I don't want to feel them anymore. The good emotions make me feel good. I'd like to feel them all of the time. But it's not that simple, and really, truthfully, emotions aren't good or bad. They just are. And so instead of treating our feelings as good or bad, what happens is we step away and look at them and process them differently. He said, emotions keep you from really understanding what you're feeling. Judging your emotions as good or bad, it keeps you from fully understanding, well, why do I feel this way? I hate feeling guilty. It makes me sick to my stomach. But sometimes guilt is necessary to make me see something that I need to do differently. And there's a big difference between guilt and shame, which is a whole nother thing. But some emotions we feel that do have a negative feeling, it's not bad that we feel those. It's actually healthy and necessary and allows us to process different. So he said, instead of treating all your feelings as bad and good, suspend judgment for a minute. Just suspend judgment and allow the emotion to run its course, because what happens is when you do, you work your way through it and it vanishes. The opposite is if you try to say, this is a bad feeling and I don't want to feel it, and you squash it down, it's like the beach ball effect. Have you ever tried to hold a ball underwater? You can hold it, but eventually you're going to slip, or you're going to lose your footing, or you're not going to hold it anymore, and it's going to come crashing out. And when it crashes out, what happens? It makes a huge splash, knocks. That's how emotions work. When I try to squash my emotions, instead of just suspending judgment and letting myself feel them, they're coming out in ways that I can't always control, and usually with some pretty ugly side effects. That's number one. Number two, he says, observe the ripple effects of your emotions. What happens is your emotions have a ripple effect. Just like in the water, just like when you throw a stone and it ripples out from there, when we respond emotionally, it has a ripple effect on people around us. He says, continuing to think that your emotions are powerful weapons. Continuing to think that the effects are instant and minimal will only do you a disservice. The key to observing these effects of your emotions is to watch closely how they impact the people immediately around you. The next time you lose your temper, just watch and see how the people around you look. The next time you don't do the thing that you said you were going to do, just look how that has an effect on the people around you. The next time your emotions go crazy, look how it affects the people around you, and use that information as a guide for how your emotions are bound to affect a wider circle long after you unleash the emotion. Here's how you know this is true. You can still remember something your parents did that had an effect on who you are today, for good or for bad. It's still there. And what happens is, in the moment, we like to minimize how our emotions affect people. But guess what? Down the road, there are places that those still have an effect. And self-control is necessary to understand how my emotions affect people around me. And then here's a third one. It's huge. Number three, lean into your discomfort. So the biggest obstacle to increasing your self-awareness is the tendency to avoid the discomfort that comes from seeing yourself as you really are. It says, but you'll never be able to manage yourself effectively if you ignore what you need to do to change. It's hard to look in the mirror at ourselves sometimes. It's hard to turn that focus inward and say, I'm not good here. I want to be so bad. Like, I want to be, and I want people to think that I am, but I messed up. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have responded that way. I don't want to be that person. That's uncomfortable. We'd much rather ignore it. We'd much rather forget it. We'd much rather act like it didn't happen and it's not real and move on with tomorrow. But what happens is, if we don't lean into the discomfort of learning who we are and becoming more aware of who we are and how we're living right now, we don't ever get to the other side that figures out how to manage ourselves well. It says, rather than avoiding a feeling, your goal should be to move toward the emotion. I don't like it. I really don't. I don't want to move toward it. I want to move away from it. But he says, move toward the emotion, into it. You have to go through to get out, because then you eventually get on the other side of it. He said, when you ignore or minimize an emotion, no matter how small or insignificant, you miss the opportunity to do something productive with that feeling. said, to be effective in life, we all need to discover our own arrogance. He calls us not doing this arrogant. It's arrogant because the things we didn't bother to learn about ourselves and we dismiss them as unimportant is an arrogant attitude towards the emotions that we feel. But here's the good side. He said, the surprising thing about increasing your self-awareness is that just thinking about it will help you change. Even though much of your focus is initially going to be on the things that you do wrong, feels like you can't get beat up one more time, he said, don't be afraid of the emotional mistakes. Every single one of them is an opportunity that we get to learn from and say, okay, I can learn from this. I can do it differently. I can understand this. I can have this new innovation, these new ideas to understand myself better as my life unfolds. Fourth, he says, keep a journal about your emotions. Said another obstacle to developing the self-awareness is objectivity. We aren't very objective when it comes towards self. And he said it's really, really hard to get perspective on your emotions and your tendencies when every day feels like a new mountain to climb. It's really hard to understand your emotions when you forget what you did last week, right? It's really hard to understand some of the choices that we make when it feels like we're just trying to survive today. Like, I'd just like to get through today in one piece, without harming the children, right? Like, I'd like to be a good person today, but what happens is we forget and we never process the things that happen. So instead, start writing it down. Just write everything down. This happened and I was annoyed. This happened and my feelings were hurt. This happened and I felt like they didn't appreciate me enough. This happened and I lost my temper. This happened and I was mean. This happened, and I sulked on it for a week, right? Just start writing everything down, your time at work, your time at home, your time with your friends, your time with your family. And what happens is, as you start writing everything down, which again feels incredibly awkward, like we're not 12, but it feels that way, write everything down, you start seeing patterns in your life. You start seeing these situations that push your buttons. You start seeing how you respond to certain people, and you couldn't figure out why you felt a certain way, but now you see the pattern to who you were around, and you start making new connections. And it helps you see yourself more clearly. So write down your emotions helps you make these tendencies more clear and more understandable, and it's a great place that you get to learn from and grow from. I said, number five, visit your values. Said lots of things that we have in life to keep us balanced, right? Like we're trying to balance a lot. Our home and our job and feeding kids and life and bills and hectic schedules and getting everybody where they need to go and maintaining this balance, he said, keeps your attention focused outward rather than inward and on yourself. As you run around struggling to check your silly to-dos off the list, it's easy to lose sight of what's really important, your core values and your beliefs. Said you find yourself doing and saying things that deep down don't feel good, you don't feel good about, or you believe in. What happens is we get so busy doing that we forget, I said I want to be this kind of a person. We get so busy going that we forget, I never wanted to talk that way. We get so busy with the craziness of life that we forget, I said this was the commitment to the kind of person that I want to be. But the trick is to take the time to check in with yourself and jot down your core values and beliefs. Write this question down. What are the values that I wish to live my life by? If you ever just process that, like what are the values that I say I want to live my life by? These are deal breakers for me, right? Like I value honesty. I value compassion. I value faith. I value joy. I value fun. I believe that there is hope for the future. Write down the things that are values for your life and then just do a cross check every once in a while. When I did that hold up with my value of honesty? When I made this decision, did that connect with my value of compassion? When I did this, did this connect to the value of faith and the kind of girl that I feel like God's calling me to be? And here's the last one, seek feedback. Said everything that we see about ourselves has to travel through our own lens, right? I see things the way I see them, but the problem is every one of our lens is tainted with our own experiences, our own backgrounds, our own beliefs, and our moods and our emotions taint some of the ways that we see things. There's a huge difference between how you see yourself and how others see yourself. So this big space in between gives you a place to learn from. If I see myself this way, but my family sees myself this way, where's the gap? What is the thing that I can do to learn from this gap that exists? This is a huge place of getting to know yourself from the inside and from the outside. But here's the thing. You can't just ask anybody for feedback. Some people won't give you trustworthy feedback. Some people are going to be mean. Some people don't care. So when you're looking for feedback, look for trusted sources that you know. Number one, they can be objective. Number two, they're not so close to the situation that they have an emotional response to it and their feedback they're giving you is how they feel about something. Find a trusted resource who can just be objective and honest with you and give you some feedback and help see how these perspectives start to overlap. Okay, I'm gonna pull this all together. Self-management allows us to get control of our lives. It allows us to start working through a process to start thinking about the choices that we make, rather than waiting until I'm in a moment of overwhelming temptation and then beating myself up as a jerk because I didn't do the thing that I wanted to do. Instead, we take a step back and plan better for life. We plan better for the decisions we want to make. We know some of the things that we struggle with. Nobody has to tell us that. We get it. It's there. We know it's true. And I say I want to have a better plan for when this happens because I don't want to do the same thing that I've always done. There's one last idea that he gives that I want, and it's this idea of time. He uses Tolstoy, and he says, the two strongest warriors are time and patience. The power of these warriors comes from their ability to transform situations, ease pain, and provide clarity. Some situations just need time. Some moments require our patience, and they're uncomfortable because we want to like swoop in and take out the uncomfortable. We want to swoop in and fix it. We want to swoop in and change it. But time and patience allows us to live in that tension for a moment instead of jumping in just to alleviate the tension. Sometimes you just need to give yourself a minute. Give yourself an hour. Give yourself a day, give yourself a week, give yourself a month. There's no time limit that we have to press ourselves into. And what happens is time helps us self-manage because we have to step back, gain control of our emotions, and think about it in a different way. Which means we have to find ways throughout the day and our week to squeeze out little moments of time. It's so funny because one of the big things he talks about is like, remember you learned in kindergarten, like count to 10? When you feel like you're going to get really angry, like my kids, we do Daniel Tiger, take a deep breath, count to four. All right. So it's crazy, but you actually can study the science. When you flood your brain with oxygen, you have more ability to think objectively than you do when you're going, do you ever get so stressed out and angry you can't quite breathe, right? You're like panting a little bit. He said these short, small breaths are actually depriving our brain of oxygen, which helps us make good decisions. We need all the oxygen we can get. So just sometimes when you feel the anger bubbling over, do the thing you learned as a child. Take big breaths, right? I look silly. I get it, but I'm not yelling at you, right? Count to 10 and then try again. Or give yourselves measured amounts of space in your day to just walk away from it all. Give yourselves 15 minutes, just 15 minutes of quiet time to think through and process your day. This is an incredible spiritual discipline. You've heard it before, silence and solitude. And what happens is it allows us to just process and think. To just take the space to think about all that we need to do. Because life is loud, and it's busy, and it's obnoxious, and it moves at incredibly fast paces, and we need moments where we can reconnect to the wonder and awesomeness of who God is and who he's called us to be. There's this incredible book about silence. Look what it says. Good things come from a quiet place. Study, prayer, music, transformation, worship, communion. The words peace and quiet are all but synonymous, often spoken in the same breath. A quiet place is the think tank of the soul. It is the spawning ground of truth and beauty. A quiet place affords sanctuary for the soul, where the difference between right and wrong becomes more readily apparent. A quiet place is a place to open up all of your senses and come alive. Every one of us has the ability to grow in our self-control, but it requires time, and it requires patience, and it requires practice. So what if this week we just started taking 15 minutes a day and practicing one of these strategies and seeing what might happen, who we might become, how we might change and grow by just learning a little bit more self-control? Dear Heavenly Father, I thank you for this day. I thank you for this time. I pray that you would help us. Father, we strongly desire to be the guys and girls that you've called us to be. But I acknowledge we come up short and we don't always get there. So I pray that you would help us. Father, I pray for myself and I pray for every heart here, Father, that you would stir up something within us to just try better this week, to just take one thing and practice it in our lives, Father, that we might make better life choices, that we might take better control of who we are, our emotions, our impulses, and the result would be stronger faith, stronger hearts, and stronger lives for you. Would you help us, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen.